The ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah, so far, so good.
Thousands of residents of southern Lebanon streamed back to their homes Wednesday as cessation of hostilities appeared to hold.
A night of violence in Islamabad.
There have been claims of like more than 200 people killed, but where are the bodies? The wounded have been missing.
And Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services.
I'm going to let him go wild on health. I'm going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on medicines.
Today is Thursday, November 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Cautious optimism in the Middle East as a U.S.-brokered ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah held throughout its first day as thousands of Lebanese returned to their homes in southern Lebanon. Many in Israel hope the ceasefire will also lead to an end to the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. VOA's Linda Gradstein has more from Jerusalem.
Defying Israeli warnings not to return, thousands of residents of southern Lebanon streamed back to their homes Wednesday as cessation of hostilities appeared to hold. During the more than 13 months of heavy fighting between Israel and Hezbollah, more than a million Lebanese fled their homes in the south and in Beirut. Some returning Lebanese on Wednesday waved Hezbollah flags, saying they are still mourning the late Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, assassinated by Israeli forces in September. Among those returning on Wednesday was Kauthar, a Beirut resident who did not give her full name.
I came to check on our things, on our families and relatives. We have martyrs and we have sacrificed. We want to tell Hassan Nasrallah that we are still with you.
According to the ceasefire terms, Hezbollah is to withdraw north of the Litani River, and Israeli troops will gradually leave South Lebanon to be replaced by about 10,000 Lebanese army soldiers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu assured his people that Israel has full backing from the United States to act against any violation of the ceasefire. But some Israeli analysts say Israel has made similar pledges before and has not responded to Hezbollah violations of ceasefires in the past. Yaakov Amidror is a fellow at the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security.
The importance of the agreement is not about signing it. It's about implementing it. Is how Israel, the IDF, will react to violation, the first and the second and the third violation of Hezbollah. We should react without any proportion to the violation.
In Israel, many of the 60,000 residents who were forced to leave their homes more than a year ago were skeptical that the ceasefire will last. They said that Israel should have continued the war in Lebanon until Hezbollah was destroyed. Moran Brustin is a resident of Kibbutz HaGoshrim, next to the border with Lebanon.
It's a problem that we stopped the war, but we didn't finish the job. And although I don't support war, but it seems like nothing changed. It was a siren like 2 minutes ago, and I had to put my kids down the floor and lay on top of them because we don't have a safe room in the house. And nothing's changed, so what guarantee that something will change?
Others, like Orna Weinberg from Kibbutz Manara, say they want the infrastructure rebuilt before they come back.
Over 75% of the apartments in the kibbutz were hit, including, obviously, my home and all five apartments of my family members. The infrastructure of the kibbutz, public buildings, everything. It's going to take us over a year to get back home after everything is finished.
Many Israelis say they are concerned about how the ceasefire agreement in Lebanon will affect a ceasefire and hostage deal in Gaza. Some hope that Hamas will feel isolated and more receptive to a deal, while others fear the Lebanon ceasefire will distract the world's attention from the ongoing plight of the hostages still held in Gaza. Linda Gradstein, VOA News, Jerusalem.
Looking now at Russia and Ukraine, one of the bigger challenges facing Russia as it seeks to assert itself militarily isn't the lack of weapons, it's the lack of babies. The nation is projected to lose up to half of its population by the end of the century. In response, Moscow is stepping up its war on what it calls the Western-style liberal influence with a law that fines anyone who promotes a childless lifestyle. Elizabeth Chernev narrates this report by Ricardo Marquina.
Having children in Russia or not having them is still a personal choice, but promoting a child-free lifestyle publicly is now banned. The Russian parliament, the Duma, approved legislation in November imposing fines on those who, according to the new law, advance, quote, propaganda of conscious refusal to bear children. The measure is the work of legislators who accuse the West of spreading a liberal ideology that is influencing young Russian couples to avoid having kids. One of those lawmakers is Sergei Boyarsky of Russian President Vladimir Putin's United Russia Party.
This is certainly an element of a large hybrid war waged against our country, along with propaganda of drugs, pedophilia, propaganda of gender change, untraditional sexual relations, propaganda of suicide.
The government has not named specific individuals or organizations it is targeting, but the few human rights associations still working inside Russia see the law as an instrument of repression. Sofia Rusova is with the Center for the Defense of Domestic Violence Victims in Moscow.
There is less and less public space for different points of view to be expressed. These measures are just to prohibit talking about the problems of motherhood.
Activists who have had to flee Russia for opposing the Kremlin's invasion of Ukraine blame the war for what they see as a draconian measure to smash the debate over birth control. This is what Roxana Kisileva, self-exiled coordinator of a group called the Feminist Anti-War Committee, believes. She asked us not to disclose her location outside Russia for her own security.
Now, a woman can be fined if she says she doesn't want to give birth to children in this economy, in this situation, when there is war. If she says publicly that she doesn't think it's safe to have children now.
United Nations projections say falling birth rates and an aging population mean Russia, which now has about 144 million people, may have half that number by the end of this century. The Russian leadership sees this as a catastrophic scenario for a nation with the largest territory in the world. For Ricardo Marquina, Elizabeth Chernev, VOA News.
Pakistani authorities arrested nearly 1,000 supporters of jailed former Prime Minister Imran Khan and his Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, or PTI, who stormed into the capital this week to demand his release, the city's police chief said on Wednesday. Khan's aides alleged, without immediately providing evidence, that hundreds had suffered gunshot wounds during chaotic scenes overnight in the heart of Islamabad as police dispersed protesters, led by Khan's wife, who had broken through security barricades. The protests left three security officers dead, apparently run over by one of their own vehicles, according to witnesses. After that, authorities violently dispersed the crowd that had gathered for a sit-in protest. I'm joined by Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad for the latest.
It started, they started converging on Islamabad on Sunday.
Okay.
And because there was a very large number of people coming from, especially northwest frontier region, Monday night, they arrived on the outskirts of Islamabad. And then Tuesday, they managed to reach to the central Islamabad place where they wanted to stage this sit-in protest.
And that's where the violence broke out.
And that's where, what they did yesterday, after the sunset, authorities cut off the power in the entire area. And using the advantage of the darkness, they started heavy tear gas shelling and, in fact, gunfire that could be heard. And that's why it is very, very disturbing situation today in Pakistan that there have been claims of like more than 200 people killed. But where are the bodies? The wounded have been missing. Hospital officials have been told by government. They're not talking to reporters. They're not releasing any details, whether they received any wounded people or any bodies. So there's a mystery that is now prevailing currently, and people are really looking for their loved ones. So it's a very disturbing situation.
So the protesters, they came from all over the country, it sounds like, to protest the imprisonment of Imran Khan, a former prime minister. And what else were they seeking? What else did they want?
Well, the top three demands were that they insisted that Imran Khan, because most of the convictions or his sentences have either been overturned by appeals courts or suspended, so he's being kept in jail illegally. So they wanted to press the government to release him. Secondly, this current government has introduced a few amendments in the constitution, and which Imran Khan's party believes is something that the current government does not have the authority. The protesters demanded that this should be withdrawn. And the third demand was also, there have been dozens of PTI leaders and activists who have been in jail for the last year or so. And the demand is, and PTI believes or alleges that there has been no formal charges against these detainees, and they must be freed, and they call them political prisoners and victimization, political victimization. So these were the three things that they really wanted to press the government to address these demands. And the commitment from the leadership of PTI, Imran Khan, was that unless and until these demands are met, these protesters will remain in this central part, which is called D Chowk Public Square, near the parliament, that they will remain there until their demands are met and will not leave. Now we are hearing this morning when we woke up and we tried to visit hospitals and find out details from the two main hospitals, whether there were any casualties. Surprisingly, doctors were not willing to speak to journalists. Some of them, off the record, anonymously told reporters that they have been ordered by the government not to share any details about whether they received any casualties. So that is why, as of this moment, it is not clear how many people actually were killed. The government has acknowledged that these three paramilitary troops were crushed by a vehicle. The government claims that it was it were the protesters who killed these paramilitary forces. But then when you look at the events, the way they unfolded before this accident happened, that actually one of the vehicles of the one of the police vehicles was retreating because they had run out of tear gas shells. So in a rush, they crushed a group of people where some security personnel were also standing there, and there were some protests and they were crushed. But the government blamed the protest organizers for killing these three officers. And now we are hearing from the top leadership of Imran Khan's party, the PTI, that they have been able to confirm at least 20 deaths of their supporters or protesters in overnight firing by the police, and that they're going to approach the courts and seek justice.
VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad. Ayaz, thanks for your time. Thanks for your reporting on this developing story for us.
Thank you.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Authorities in Sri Lanka say at least five people have died, including three children, and five others are still missing after heavy downpours and strong winds over the past 2 days flooded homes, fields, and roads, and forced authorities to suspend train service in mountain areas. Sri Lanka has been grappling with severe weather since May, mostly caused by heavy monsoon rains.
Marius Borg Hoiby, the eldest son of Norway's crown prince, has been released after his arrest last week on rape allegations, according to his lawyer. Borg Hoiby is the stepson of the heir to the Norwegian throne and has no royal title or official duties. Police said Wednesday that an investigation has been opened into a further matter relating to sexual offenses.
A ban on transgender students from kindergarten through college using bathrooms that fit their gender identities has become law in the U.S. state of Ohio. The announcement Wednesday adds to a string of recent bills affecting transgender people nationally. The new law says public and private schools must designate separate accommodations for, quote, the exclusive use of males and females based on the gender one was assigned at or near birth.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. Looking now at the upcoming transition of power in the U.S. and the administration of President-elect Donald Trump, he says he intends to nominate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, even as Kennedy disagrees with much of the scientific community on subjects including vaccines and HIV/AIDS. VOA's Anita Powell has our story.
President-elect Donald Trump's message to his pick for top health advisor was simple. Go wild, he said, at a rally just before the election.
I'm going to let him go wild on health. I'm going to let him go wild on the food. I'm going to let him go wild on medicines.
Kennedy's room to go wild at the Department of Health and Human Services includes the nation's public health agencies and its medical research, along with government-funded health insurance for more than 140 million people.
Don't we deserve a president of the United States that's going to make America healthy again?
Kennedy is an environmental lawyer. His uncle was former President John F. Kennedy, and his father was former Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy. He ran for president this year as an independent candidate, quitting a Democratic Party that he said his father and uncle would not recognize, in part because of what he says are the party's ties to large pharmaceutical companies.
It has become the party of censorship. It's become the party of big pharma.
During the coronavirus pandemic, Kennedy backed false claims that included links between vaccines and autism, and the existence of a U.S. government conspiracy to use COVID vaccines to experiment on Black and Hispanic Americans. Kennedy says he is not against all vaccines, but he does not want them to be mandatory.
Anybody who wants to take a vaccine, I'm not going to get in their way. If you want a vaccine or if you want to vaccinate your children, those vaccines will be available.
The World Health Organization calls vaccines a global success story that have saved millions of lives, a stance the UN body repeated shortly after Trump announced his intention to nominate Kennedy to the top health post. Dr. Margaret Harris is a World Health Organization spokeswoman.
Vaccines are the reason so many more of us have survived to adulthood than we ever did before. They are so effective that they're almost a victim of their success.
Kennedy's vaccine skepticism could affect whether insurance companies continue to cover them, says former Biden administration coronavirus response coordinator Dr. Ashish Jha.
RFK Jr. has demonstrated, I think, over decades that he doesn't understand the basics of scientific thinking and of rigorous analysis. He says things that are just flatly wrong, and he peddles in conspiracy theories.
Public health advocates have expressed concerns about Kennedy's views that HIV does not cause AIDS and that fluoride should be removed from U.S. drinking water. House Republican leader Mike Johnson says Trump and his cabinet have a mandate to shake things up.
The status quo is not working for the American people. And so these are persons who will go in and bring real reform, a significant reform to the agencies that they lead.
If confirmed, Kennedy would head an agency of more than 80,000 employees across the United States and around the world with a budget of $1.7 trillion. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
There's a lot on the line in Namibia as voters cast their ballots for a new president and parliament on Wednesday. As Diane Toe of Reuters reports, it's a competitive election that could threaten the long-running dominance of the ruling SWAPO party.
Voters waited in long lines outside polling stations in Namibia's capital, Windhoek, on Wednesday morning. It's an election that could mark a historic shift in the country's political landscape if the ruling SWAPO party loses the presidency or control of parliament for the first time. SWAPO has governed the Southern African nation since leading it to independence from apartheid South Africa in 1990. Its presidential candidate is Netumbo Nandi Ndaitwa, the current vice president.
Voting is not just your constitutional responsibility, but it is also your national responsibility.
Nandi Ndaitwa would be the country's first female leader if she wins. She faces 14 opposition candidates in Namibia's most competitive election in decades. Presidential candidates need more than 50% of the ballot to win, or there will be a runoff. SWAPO saw support fall to 56% in the 2019 presidential election from 87% in 2014. Political analysts say there's a chance SWAPO could be ousted by young people fed up with high unemployment, inequality, and corruption allegations. Although long-standing loyalty to the party among older and rural voters could help pull it through. Namibia has seen relatively strong economic growth in recent years, driven by investments in oil, gas, and green hydrogen. But it ranks second highest in the world for income inequality, according to World Bank figures. About 1.4 million people are registered to vote in the sparsely populated country of around 3 million, according to the Electoral Commission. Results are expected within a few days.
That's Diane Toe of Reuters reporting for us. Thursday is Thanksgiving in America. And as the mythology goes, the British settlers who arrived in what is now Massachusetts were cold, hungry, and ill-prepared for the winter. The Wampanoag people, the Native Americans living in the area, helped the British and taught them to farm indigenous crops and hunt local game and showed them the abundance around them. What started as a disastrous situation ended with a celebratory feast. At least that's the story. The British settlers were experiencing food insecurity, as are millions of people around the world today. And Feed the Children is there, on the ground, to help. Bree Jefferson is president of Feed the Children's international operation, and she joins me for a discussion about the importance of their work, especially today.
So we are active all over the world. We do work in the U.S., but we also do work international in El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Kenya, Malawi, Tanzania, Uganda, and the Philippines. And we are a hunger organization, and the work we do is to really work in every single location. We look at food insecurity and how can we disrupt that.
So how do you disrupt food insecurity? What works? And is it the same everywhere?
It's not the same everywhere. And that's such a great question, because one of the pillars that we strive for is we meet communities where they're at. So the work in Malawi is going to be different than the work in Guatemala. The work in Guatemala is somewhat different than the work in El Salvador. And what we try to do is, I'll give you a great example. We have a very large project in Malawi, and it's funded by our partners, USAID. And how we try to disrupt this is we're looking at, how do we help provide human dignity, right? When you are hungry and you're food insecure or you're malnutrition, you start to lose your hope and you start to lose your dignity. And so we look at this in a very holistic way of how can we help the community have better livelihood programs through our village savings and loans, but also training our caregivers. Then we work with the health departments to really make sure, again, hunger has an effect on a human's well-being and their health. And so how do we partner with those?
Now, I don't need to tell you there are hungry people and needy communities all over the world. How do you decide where to go with your limited resources?
That's such a hard question. You know, we look at the global index, right? The global hunger index. So in 2024, hunger strikes the hardest in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia. And then here in the U.S., it's Louisiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Arkansas. But going to these places requires resource and funding. We also want to make sure we stay in communities till we help them get stabilized. And so for us, when we look at where the greatest needs are, we take all of those indicators to make decisions about where we want to go.
Thanksgiving in the United States is... it's a family holiday, but it's a holiday centered around food. And food is very important, not just for nourishment, but for culture. Can you speak to how Feed the Children improves people's lives, not just puts food in their bellies?
So it's one of the beauties about our organization is it's also about essentials, right? And you, what you said to me was absolutely beautiful. Food isn't just about this kind of concept of putting something in someone's belly. It is really about how can you help provide food and life essentials to help a family see the future. You know, one of the things I remind people about is, you know, my parents had the hope that I had a better future. I have the hope that my kids have a better future. And so what we try to do with that nourishment, using it in the most broadest sense, is we find ways to nourish families. We find ways to say, if we're giving you an essential or helping provide you essential, that's less money they're having to spend on that, right? So part of giving food and providing essentials is we want to look at this from a very holistic way.
Bree Jefferson is the president of Feed the Children International. Ms. Jefferson, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this conversation.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform. and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.